encouraged, not burdened by the history that they create. They know what is expected of them. They are Manchester United.
Hello, listeners. Probably not the voice you expected to hear right off the jump. Colin is here, along with me, Pauly. We are here for, I guess, a post-mortem of this 2021-22 season, a season that nobody wants to remember even happened, and it's been about a week and a half, so it's been a while, and we're asking you to go and look back again.
It's sort of like a Man United 21-22 autopsy.
Yeah, that was the idea here of to really go back and go through the season from a bit of a tactical level, because I think at the end of the season, you get the benefit of hindsight. And whereas when we're living in the moment, you're caught up in everything. And right now you get to look and you can break up the season into chunks. You can see when you look back at a season, you could see when you look at a period of games, you could see what a manager was trying to build, or you could see, those are the building blocks to what ultimately got accomplished. For example, I knew that the Aston Villa match was tactically Ralph got outdone against Steven Gerrard. And then today when I reread the piece that I wrote on it, I was like, I saw a lot of themes that came up after that. And I'm like, this is something to discuss, and we'll get to it, of the beginning of things were starting to be shown in that match. But at the time, we thought it was a one-off. And then when you look back at the season, you can really take the macro.
Yeah, I feel like that's happened a few times this season. It's like we didn't realize that we were spiraling until, on two separate occasions, things were spiraling. And we didn't really realize how bad it was until we were able to put some perspective on it. And there were things where it seemed like, there were certain positives we could take away from some games at certain parts of the season, or we thought maybe this means this or in like a positive way, like we can turn things around. But looking back on it now, it's kind of easier to see the bigger picture of what was happening, I guess.
Yeah, Colin, you have no idea how many times this happened. I went through writing up this sheet for this show, and the amount of times that I wrote turning point ?
I see it in our little like itinerary for this podcast, which is like turning point. It's like
so many times when you look back at things, we could see it in a different light. We're going to try to be as objective as possible. We're going to stick with the on-field stuff and what happened. Like we will be talking about Mason Greenwood. We're going to be focused because he did play in several games. We're going to try not to let our personal feelings get in the way of everything. So let's just dive in. Let's start. And like, where better to start than, I guess, the beginning of the season? United come into the season on the backs of a 74-point season where they finished second in the league and didn't win the Europa League final. Second in the league, it's well pointed out. They got that high because Liverpool had a season where anything and everything that could go wrong went wrong for them. Some will throw Chelsea in there as well, though Chelsea the last few years kind of average about 71, 72-ish points. So 74 points probably would have been enough even on to beat out Chelsea in a regular year. And there's definitely some things that United need to address, but they moved swiftly to sign Jadon Sancho. And Colin, what would you say the expectations were at the start of the season? So let's go a week before the first game. At this point, they've signed Sancho. There's nothing else going on. There's plenty of Rafael Varane rumors. You've got a lot of reporters being like, it's basically a done deal, but it hasn't been announced yet. And we get a lot of other rumors basically saying the club's not going to sign anybody else unless we get outgoings. So what were the expectations, I think, of a whole, and what do you think they should have been?
I think, I mean, going into the season, the expectation was obviously to improve. It felt like 2021 was a year where Manchester United grew. Especially at the time, it was a bit harder to tell whether, you know, Liverpool were going to have stumbles again, or whether they were just going to go back to dominating like we've seen them do this season. There was a lot of hype about Chelsea. I was a little bit more worried about Liverpool than Chelsea at the beginning of the season, but generally I thought Manchester United would finish top four again. I didn't think it would be a problem. I didn't think some of the title expectations were fair, I guess, when it comes to judging Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, especially, you know, in hindsight. But he'd kind of made his reputation by that point as Manchester United manager as someone who was able to fix problems pretty quickly and find something that worked for the next stretch of games. And if something else crops up, then he'll address it then too. And a lot of those problems stemmed from not having a midfielder that could take control of games and allow the creators to do their thing without worrying about leaving a massive hole between the attack and the defense. Not addressing that was going to be a big problem. And I mean, just, you know, from talking with you that summer, I think a lot of us were hopeful that maybe they would at least bring in somebody to try and, you know, add depth to a position that lacked both quality and depth. But that obviously didn't happen.
Yeah, I thought coming into the season, top four was that they were the one of among the four best teams in England. I thought the title race was, the title talk was something that spurned from this false position in the table of you finish second because Liverpool had a bad year, and people look at the table and go, well, you finish second, the only place to go from there is first, or at least compete with being first. United improved from 2019-20 to 2020-21 by 8 points, which is a nice improvement. But let's be honest, even if, unless you believe City were on the way down, even if you improve by another 8 points, let's say they take a massive step forward and improve by 10 points, 84 points not going to get the job done.
Right. So I think another part of this, though, is that even with, you know, like, I mean, there are fans who are not going to, you know, recognize that reality year in and year out, that you probably need at least 95 points to be in the title race at this point. But Manchester United under Ole, in his two full seasons, did really well in cups and just couldn't get over the line near the end of them. Like that was the trend in almost every cup run up until this season under Ole. So the idea of being able to win something and, you know, adding that sort of like grit and confidence to a team building process is really important. And getting to the Europa League final and not getting over the line, you know, it's something that's going to boost expectations, but is also going to weigh on the mind a little bit.
Yeah, I think that Europa League final did, the not getting it over the line really hurt them. But back to the expectations, I do remember writing for some website asked me to come on and do a preview. And I remember distinctly saying, they're one of the four best teams in England. They'll finish in the top four. But if they don't address the midfield, they will make that as difficult as possible. By the end of the previous season, we were seeing Ole really using a lot of duct tape to tape over the fact that everybody knew how to beat this midfield. And this is going to be a theme throughout the entire season. For whatever you think the problems were with United, whether you think that they all come down to one player or a different or something else, most of them could have been really, really mitigated by just having a decent midfield, and a lot of the problems that did happen just shined a brighter spotlight on the lack of midfield. So the season gets underway. They announce Rafael Varane signing right before the match at Old Trafford, at a full Old Trafford, the first time Old Trafford's been full in almost 2 years or a year and a half. They blow the hell out of Leeds. It's I mean, obviously, the benefit of hindsight is it's easily the highlight of the season, which is sad because it's the first day.
And also because it was Leeds and they were not as good as they were in the first season in the Premier League.
Yeah. So you don't learn much from a match against Leeds because they are so unique and it's such a perfect matchup for United. But we do sort of see the blueprint of how Solskjaer wants the team to play. You have your base of midfield of McTominay and Fred and Paul Pogba on the left wing, but really given the freedom to go anywhere and be that free midfielder. Mason Greenwood's your striker, but it's not staying as a fixed number nine. He's moving around and Bruno's making runs off of that and getting into the box. And that's how Bruno ends up with a hat trick. Greenwood has a very good goal. You get Fred making a late run into the box to score a goal. Again, though, you don't learn anything from this. They go to Southampton where it's immediately a sobering 1-1 draw with Southampton that I call it the Fred game because everybody wanted to ship Fred off to Siberia from this match, which I think was a really bad analysis of this match. I think this is one of the most misunderstood matches they played all season. How did you feel about this match, Colin?
I mean, I thought it was a bummer, but I didn't think it was anything like unusual from what we'd seen, I guess. I think it reminded me of the start to 1920 when we blew out Chelsea and then go to Wolves and are immediately like, oh, teams aren't going to play this open against us. You know, this was a Southampton team that was still, at the time, they were trying to figure out what their new game plan was going to be because they'd had a couple players exit. They'd brought in players from lower levels or from, you know, their reserves to try and paper over the cracks. And it seemed going into it like maybe it was going to be another attempt to or another chance to blow a team out of the water. But in the end, what we got was kind of similar to how Southampton has played before, which is they're very well managed and they knew what they were about from the start of this game. And I agree about Fred. I was pretty harsh at the time because I think
he gave the ball away a million times.
Yeah. yeah.
He gave the ball away a million times, but defensively, this was one of United's top three defensive matches of the season.
They weren't really threatened outside of that. I mean, it was just another case of Manchester United not being able to break down a team in possession.
Yeah, they gave Southampton nothing. There was one chance in the second half that Harry Maguire had to pull someone down after McTominay like left him out to dry. And they got a very unlucky own goal, which at the time, if you saw that now, this season everything could have went wrong. It ended up becoming a theme of the season, but at the time it was just, you're looking at the back of last season and you're saying, oh, United find another way to fall behind 1-0 early. But you're right, they didn't get any attack going because as much as the blueprint was laid out against Leeds, Solskjaer did change something up. He brought in Anthony Martial for Daniel James. Nemanja Matic came in for the injured McTominay. Southampton knew how to stop this. That 4-2-2-2 that they play, they just sat off. They had two players sitting on Bruno and Pogba the entire match. And then everybody else, they sat off. They sat off of Maguire and Lindelof and sat on Matic and Fred and went, you're not going to pass the ball up the middle. You have to go to the outsides. And then once they went to the outsides, they would trap Shaw and Wan-Bissaka. That is lovely landscaping. They would trap Shaw and Wan-Bissaka, forcing them their only options now to get the ball ahead to a Greenwood or a Bruno, Pogba, Martial, whoever was on the left side, was to go vertical, which meant they were fielding the ball with their backs to goal right on the touchline with a man right on their back. Very difficult to do anything with that. Southampton still had players cutting off the passing lanes to Bruno and Pogba, so Wan-Bissaka, Shaw couldn't get the ball there. The only place they could go with was Fred and Matic, and it was basically you put the ball back in the middle to Fred and Matic, and they need to move it quickly to catch Southampton before they can reset, and Matic isn't going to do that, so he didn't try. Fred tried, and he failed over and over again, which is why he gave the ball away so often. And it looked like he was having a terrible game, but it's just Fred's not good at that. He was just trying to do something. And in the second half, Solskjaer first took off Martial, brought on Jadon Sancho, and for about the next 15 to 20 minutes, United started to cook and came very close to scoring a couple of times. Probably would have scored if he kept going, but then he took Fred off and United completely lost the midfield, and that was it for the match. They no longer had a chance to win, so it's kind of
another, you know, in hindsight, it kind of set a new trend for the season of go 1-0 down, get one back, and then what do you do? You know, this is a team that they have problems breaking down opposition that sit back against them, or they're very well organized against them. It was also a team that didn't capitalize on a lot of chances it created for itself, or they wasted a chance in the making, I guess. And I think, you know, there were problems that we thought Jadon Sancho was going to just come in and immediately fix. And a lot of that was built on a mindset that we had coming out of the run that United were on to end the 1920 season in lockdown, because we thought that we'd found something in midfield, you know, Matic, Pogba, Bruno Fernandes ahead of him, Rashford on the left, playing off of Shaw, Mason Greenwood on the right as kind of a probably more forward than actual winger, and Anthony Martial, you know, finally turning into a nine. And a lot of that ended up just being, you know, more quick solutions that came together well, and Matic turning into his old self before once again succumbing to age.
Yeah. And we look at this one as there's also certain elements at play here of just it's the beginning of the season and some players just can't go any further. Like Jadon Sancho was recovering from like an ear infection and really just didn't have anything in the tank to go more than the 40 minutes that Solskjaer put him out on the pitch for.
I think he had COVID at one point, didn't he too?
He might have. So they get that draw. It's a bit of a disappointment. They come back a week later and they get a win against Wolves in what was definitely a worse game, but not the worst of matches. It looked bad, particularly the first 15 minutes, because Adama Traore ran right over United's midfield of Fred and Pogba, which is not the most defensively sound midfield, but Solskjaer had to change something because Fred and Matic so badly didn't work. That he goes Fred and Pogba, he brings back Daniel James basically to help with Adama, and over the first 15 minutes, he runs over everybody, doesn't score. They kept him at bay for the next 75 minutes, 75 minutes. Wolves got a couple of chances. They got a couple of chances off some set pieces, but again, they figured out how to play against United Pogba's in midfield, just double him, let Fred have the ball. And they cut off the passing lanes to Bruno and Sancho. Fred's got the ball. They funneled the ball basically from Fred to Juan Bissaka to Dan James. United really struggled to attack, not surprisingly. And they get a late goal, albeit a bit of a lucky goal, probably a foul on Pogba in the buildup, to escape with the win. 7 points after three matches, not terrible, but the Southampton match, we said, better than it looked, but in both those last two matches, extreme issues in terms of creating an attack. And for a fan base where half of them entered the season ready to see Solskjaer go, there's a lot of loud cries for there's no coaching here, there's no build-up patterns, this coach is clueless.
Yeah, it was worrying in a sense, but at the time I still thought, you know, things would be fine. Because again, you know, we've seen games like this where United struggle and the midfield structure isn't there to support the attack, but they get results and, you know, they move forward. And also just games against Wolves are, you know,
notoriously tough.
Individually, games against Wolves just have that reputation of United are kind of lucky to get a goal, but they can win 1-0 that way. This was also the game, though, and I don't know if I'm bringing this up too early, but it was the day after Manchester United signed Cristiano Ronaldo, or agreed to sign Cristiano Ronaldo.
Right.
So the vibes were starting to get weird in terms of the fan base, because, and even the media coverage, which I think is often left out when it comes to this narrative, because obviously signing Cristiano Ronaldo is going to be huge no matter what stage of his career he's in. And it's going to come with expectation to win. And it does read like a signing that you make when you're trying to win something, which Manchester United at that time thought they could do. The problem was, a lot of us realized that the biggest problem was not goal scoring. And, you know, in hindsight, it is a different conversation as well, because a lot of things have happened on and off the pitch that have changed the situation at striker and number nine. But at the time, it didn't seem like the biggest problem. It probably still isn't the biggest problem, even though it is a problem. But bringing in a really expensive goal scorer when you need to paper over cracks in midfield and figure out what the hell you're going to do for the rest of the season, because these problems are starting to pop up, you know, that's something that came back to bite Manchester United.
Yeah, this was, even for non-Ronaldo reasons, this was the game where I realized it's going to be a long season. And not so much from a United standpoint, but from a me standpoint, as someone who had to write reports or find things to write about after every game. And I was like, this is two games in a row where the most glaring problem was we don't have a midfield. And I was like, we have 35 more matches. How am I going to come up with 35 different ways to say we don't have a midfield? And yeah, that's, you go into the international break, the stars are now on United, or the lights are now on United, because they do sign Ronaldo. They end up signing Sancho, Varane, Ronaldo, which is only going to ramp up expectations. Even though when you break it down, it's like, did any of these players make them better? You can argue that Sancho should have, and that maybe he did and maybe he didn't. Rafael Varane was a center back that made United's backline better in theory, but tactically didn't make them any better. Their backline wasn't the issue the year before. It was set piece defending and midfield. And then you add the goal scorer. So, but the media is never going to go into that kind of breakdown. It's very superficial, and it's, you were in second last year, you added Cristiano Ronaldo. That's a lot of goals that are quote unquote guaranteed. You should be winning titles now.
Right.
So they come.
It was kind of the same deal with Varane too, because I mean, he's a serial Champions League winner. For most of his career, he has been one of the better center backs in Europe, and you know, he deserves his place in the Real Madrid lore for the work he did next to Sergio Ramos. But Rafael Varane played next to Sergio Ramos and Marcelo, and behind Cruz, Modric, Casemiro. You know, like they were part of a really strong team that front to back was just outstanding, and even had depth pieces that could come in and do a similar job. I mean, expecting Rafael Varane to come in and Cristiano Ronaldo to come in, and by the way, ignoring the reason that they were able to come in is because they were cheap, because they're at the end of their careers and because they're on the decline. Ignoring
all
of
that. There's a reason that their team were willing to let them go.
Right. Ignoring all of that and saying Manchester United last year adds Jadon Sancho, Cristiano Ronaldo, Rafael Varane, that team should be able to win the Premier League. That's what a lot of people, especially on TV, were thinking at the time. And, you know, saying that nobody was saying that Manchester United would win the Premier League, but it's Manchester United, so hype machine, go Burr, you know?
Yeah, so they head into the international break. They come back, and we get this set of games in September that runs from about Newcastle to Everton, where we see, now we can see there were a lot of cracks developing, but I don't know if they were necessarily the manager's fault. You have now this player that you have to integrate into a team that was not built with him in mind. He was an opportunistic signing.
And that's not just on the pitch either, as we will to discuss.
Exactly. So you get this, the Newcastle match, which is the perfect team to play in your first match back, because they are really bad. And we discussed this when we talked about it when we did a show during that international break, I said Ronaldo would score 4 goals in his first 2 games. Definitely bag a brace against Newcastle because these things always start well, and that's exactly what happened. We learned nothing from that Newcastle match because Newcastle are, in fact, really bad. There were people trying to be like, oh, this was bad, and that Solskjaer was doing a bad job. It's like they want one like by Solskjaer. Get over it. But that's just to show you that there were still people, as well as things were. United had won 3 out of 4. They had just Ronaldo arrived, 2 goals. They're still in the water, I guess, waiting for a drop of blood. They go off into the Champions League to start their Champions League campaign, jump out to a quick 1-0 lead against Young Boys. Things are going great. Then Juan Bissaka gets sent off. Colin, like, is the Juan Bissaka red card? Like, that seems to be the first of many things just starting to go downhill this season.
Like, I'm a noted Juan Bissaka defender. I've got his shirt hanging in my closet. That was a bad tackle. I think it was a little bit harsh. But, yeah, this is the first loss of the season. So it has to be, you know, the start of something. What was the game after this? They go and they beat West Ham, right?
Yeah.
And that was the game where I think it started to set in that, you know, something bad was starting to happen. The Young Boys game was bad, but you kind of, it's a little bit of a write-off because you're like, you're down for 10 men in Europe. We should probably be holding on to at least a point against Young Boys if you start with a 1-0 lead and go down to 10 men. But, you know, you lose, fine. You'll come back. You'll try and win the rest of the games in the group.
The West Ham in that match, it was Jesse Lingard gave the ball away.
Yeah. Yeah. But you look at the West Ham game, and that's the kind of game you win, and you're not supposed to win. You probably shouldn't have won. You know, you won because David De Gea saved a penalty, which never happens. It literally took a statistical anomaly for them to win this game. But that's where the rift, especially in the fan base, starts to happen, where, you know, the way Manchester United play with Cristiano Ronaldo kind of leaves them with a lot of other problems exacerbated in areas of the pitch that they probably should have addressed in the summer.
Yeah, how do you think Solskjaer managed that Young Boys match, though? Do you think he did a good job there? Granted, once you go down to 10 men with an hour to play.
Yeah, it was. So he got the red card in the 35th minute. They conceded on 66 minutes, and then they held on after that until the Jesse Lingard mistake. I mean, I don't think he managed it well, but I think it could have been worse, obviously.
Yeah, I think the Juan Bissaka red card was something that people harped on. United weren't playing well before that red card. They played a midfield of Fred and Donny van de Beek, and they were completely overrun the entire time. They had two shots in 35 minutes.
And both of them came from just, like, hoofing it to Ronaldo, right?
Right. They were both quick fire in and out. No sustained pressure. And then you go down to 10 men. I think Sancho was the initial sacrificial lamb.
Yeah, Donny then, probably wasn't soon after. I think.
And
he
then at halftime, it was van de Beek. And yeah, he did a terrible job here because it's like, you're clearly, what are you trying to do here? Like, why would you leave Ronaldo on for 45 minutes with 10 men when you've got 10 men? Everybody needs to buckle down and defend, and they're going to need to run. They're going to need to work. And with no offense to Cristiano Ronaldo, that's just not what he does. There's nothing against him. He's there to score goals. You're only going to score goals if you create chances for him to score goals. You have a midfield now of Pogba, Fred, and Bruno Fernandes. That midfield's not going to keep possession of the ball. And you've got Ronaldo not defending. So now you're basically defending with 9 men. It was a terrible, and he lets that go until about the 70th minute. And then you come back against West Ham, where we really see the first tactical tweak that he's doing to try to accommodate Ronaldo. Pogba has now dropped. In possession, he's doing whatever, but out of possession, they're kind of playing a 4-3-3, where Pogba's not really a left wing. He's really just a left central midfielder. And it kind of works, it kind of doesn't. But the team looks like a team that played an hour with 10 men 3 days prior. And it sort of hurts them in a lot of different ways. They escape with the win. It's a nice redemption story. Jesse Lingard made the turnover, and then he scores the game-winning goal. They come back 3 days later to play West Ham in the League Cup. And as Colin said before, United under Solskjaer were a good cup team. Not a good cup team this time. Solskjaer really uses the cup. He used to use the cup to like rotate players, and the League Cup, the way it came out was, I mean, in 1920, you had some injuries, but you also had just not a big squad that he had to play the Martials. And in that first game against Rochdale, Pogba and Fred, Pogba was trying to return from an injury. Fred was coming back from a strong squad. This time, you know, last year it was August, so he was trying to get everybody games because they didn't have a preseason. This time it's literally full rotation, and it's less a team and more 11 names. Here are the 11 guys that I could put on the pitch. You get Donny van de Beek playing midfield next to Nemanja Matic. 3 minutes into the game, he gets exposed by not tracking his runner. Goal. It looks a lot like the friendly against Everton, which was probably the earliest warning sign that United had. A week before the season, they played Everton in the friendly, a very bad Everton team, and United did not look good. And that midfield of Matic and van de Beek was adequate at best, which is United need their midfield to be good, but they bow out of the cup. Then you get the following week against Aston Villa. He goes back to that formation of Pogba's kind of in this left central midfielder. Bruno and Greenwood and Ronaldo are still trying to figure things out.
And that's a weird one because, I mentioned earlier, when Jadon Sancho was coming in presumably to take that right wing spot, because Mason Greenwood, as good as he was at getting the ball in the back of the net, his role was still kind of undefined and not super consistent. I guess is what I'm trying to say, which is a problem when you're trying to work out a front three and then you immediately introduce another 500K a week problem into the striker room.
Yeah. And you're adding a striker that doesn't do a lot defensively, and you keep putting him next to Mason Greenwood, who doesn't do a lot defensively. And that would sort of become more apparent week by week. But you have to remember Mason Greenwood scored four goals.
Yeah, it was like three goals in the first
three games. He was on fire, and then he came on against West Ham in the League Cup, and he was the best player on the pitch by far. Like, Solskjaer couldn't drop him because that would make people mad.
Mm-hmm. That was part of the problem with Ronaldo.
Yeah.
He was already getting criticized for – I think he was criticized in the Young Boys game for bringing off Ronaldo when he eventually did.
Maguire gets hurt against Villa. They promptly concede from a set piece. They come back down the pitch. They win a penalty. That's the big moment here. You made the comparison to Wolves, to that Wolves match in 2019-20. This is my comparison to Wolves match, because it had been a story that Solskjaer tried to defuse when they signed Ronaldo. It was who's going to take the penalties, and Solskjaer said they know. And there was no doubt here. There was no argument. Bruno took the ball, promptly stood up. You get that visual of Ronaldo like just standing right over his shoulder of like, there couldn't be more pressure on him of Ronaldo basically being like, I'm waiting for you to screw up so I can get my penalties. And Bruno promptly screws up and United lose the match. It really reminded me of that Wolves match where Rashford scored a penalty against Chelsea. And then the next week, Pogba takes the penalty and he doesn't score. If he scores that game, United win. They have 6 points. The whole beginning of the season looks different. Instead, they end up with 4 points going into the international break. These are how narratives start.
Yeah, it's really something that, I mean, whenever anything like that happens at Manchester United, it's just something to talk about, and you know people are going to listen to it. So a lot of people just latch onto it. I knew the penalty narrative was going to be a problem at some point. I just didn't think that it would be a problem because Bruno Fernandes is just so great at taking penalties. You wonder if the Ronaldo, you know, arrival and, you know, standing over his shoulder, if that like mentally took a toll on Bruno Fernandes, because I mean, that's the relationship and maintaining that status with Ronaldo is hugely important for Bruno, not just at Manchester United now, but for the Portuguese national team. You know, like, this is a guy who's always had authority over him. And when I think of penalty takers, you want somebody like Ruud van Nistelrooy, who just knows how good he is at putting the ball in the back of the net. A lot of converting penalties consistently is just about mentality. And when it becomes something everyone else can just talk about and point to as a problem, that doesn't help.
Yeah. And Bruno was like a 90-something percent penalty taker at the time, but this is the thing that we can look at in hindsight. Like, this definitely had a mental effect on Bruno. Mm-hmm. To suggest it would have been something you do at the time, we could definitively say this rattled him. They go into Villarreal. Solskjaer changes it up 4-3-3 there, where it's clear he's trying to use Bruno and Pogba to try to cover for Ronaldo, but Greenwood's not doing anything either. And all it does is it's exposing McTominay everywhere. They don't have Maguire. They don't have Shaw. So they can't get any footing into the match, and they get overrun, really. They're lucky that they were only down 1-0 and that they're able to come back, and Ronaldo saves them with a late goal. They come back to Everton. Another misremembered match that I think Solskjaer handled poorly. He drops Ronaldo, which is fine. You got to rest the guy. But right. This is where it becomes a thing of like, is there's a lot of anti-Ronaldo people who are trying to be like, well, they played really well without him. They didn't. They barely created anything. They had a 1-0 lead. I think Solskjaer was right that he needed to make a change, and Martial did come off. He probably should have brought on Pogba, because Pogba plays much better with Cavani as the striker when he's off on the left wing, and you needed to do something. The not having Maguire or Shaw from the back really hurt them, because they generated no attack. Bringing on Ronaldo was not the right move, but it became the thing. That became the story of how could you drop Ronaldo and United didn't win. And that was going to be a theme the whole rest of the season.
Yeah. I think, too, because this was going into an international break, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So when you're managing a team that has Cristiano Ronaldo on it, you have to think he's 36 going on 37. He's guaranteed to play 260 minutes every international break for a team that's pushing desperately for a World Cup spot. That was probably more on his mind than tactical shakeup. And also, he probably wanted to try and get Martial firing. It seemed like he was on his way out the door. Yeah.
Is he then goes with players rather than these pieces work together. It's I got to get Cavani minutes. I got to get Martial minutes. I can't drop Mason Greenwood. And suddenly it's like, this is where there's problems that are forming in the team. And I don't think that they are Solskjaer's fault, but Ole Gunnar Solskjaer is not doing anything to fix them, or he's not doing the right things to fix them at all.
Right. And then coming back from that is when it really, I think, starts to go on Solskjaer to the point that there's no return. If we're ready to move on to that, the Leicester City match when
Harry
Maguire comes back in a nightmare scenario, playing after one day of returning to training, and I don't think it was even full training by that point, but he comes back, he clearly doesn't look himself, and he's playing in a really hostile environment where for the entire second half, basically, Leicester City were chanting "fuck off Maguire." I mean, it was bad for Solskjaer, because he's managing the situation where you're thinking about your captain as well as your team and what's best for them. And Manchester United under Solskjaer were a better team when Maguire could play for them. And this was just a situation where you probably couldn't do that, even if you really thought you wanted to. So that's on Solskjaer. And then this really starts to kick off the narrative that fans latched onto, which is Maguire is the problem. It was a high profile, embarrassing moment for him that everyone, it's one of many narratives this season of just something that has spiraled to the point that it is now. And it sucks to see because Maguire is such a great player when he's on it. And this just becomes another obstacle when it comes to him getting back.
Yeah, you could, if you paid attention to the Villarreal and Everton matches and the end of the season last year when Maguire got hurt and how United played the rest of the way, you could completely understand why Solskjaer was eager to get Maguire back in the team if he felt he was somewhat fit over Eric Bailly, because the team just didn't function well. And it turned out to be a really bad call. Ironically, they were kind of undone by set pieces, which I don't think was because Maguire was unfit. And the ironic part here is they were really bad at set pieces 2 years ago. The season before this one. Mm-hmm. So no surprise there. It's just, they only conceded like 5 goals from set pieces all season. It was like 2 of them happened to be in this match. We continue to see him trying to figure out what United can do to play defensively with Ronaldo. And we see it over the next 3 games, which all have the same theme. It's like this 4-1-4-1, this 4-4-2, a 4-3-3 at times. It's all juggled because Mason Greenwood is also not doing anything with Ronaldo. And he's also, the two of them aren't passing to each other. So at a certain point, the benefit of playing Greenwood is, at this point, you can look and say Mason Greenwood's not in great form anymore. I understand playing him through September. Mm-hmm. And he goes, and as this happens, Greenwood sometimes pushes up, sometimes he doesn't. Leicester realize all we have to do is just be patient and gaps will form. And you quickly see how Pogba and Matic in midfield are asked to cover a ton of ground. And it just wears them out. And over the last 20 minutes of the match, Leicester take advantage of that and put them away. And the same thing happens against Atalanta with Fred and McTominay's. That halftime clip on BT Sport, like with Paul Scholes in the studio, is United in a straight up 4-2-4 with Fred and McTominay asked to cover the whole field. And it was when they announced the starting 11 against Liverpool 3 days later that Solskjaer went back with the exact same 11. It was very clear. Okay, you, as Colin said before, Solskjaer is good at solving problems. You are not solving problems here. Don't know the problem. You're not offering any solutions. And that's when it was time for him to go. And Liverpool just went, oh, this is going to be easy. And they just blew the doors off United.
Yeah. Atalanta could have been a game where, one, you learn lessons from mistakes you make, and also, two, you gain some momentum by snatching victory out of that, because coming back from 2-0 down at home to win in Europe should be really inspiring. And the fact that it wasn't, I think, just shows the kind of state that this team was in by this point. That Liverpool defeat is the worst I've felt after a Manchester United game, like, as a fan, I think.
It's not that I disagree with you. You're entitled to feel how you feel. I was numb to it at that point because I literally saw the starting 11 and I went, oh, this is what it is. It all comes back to this. Like, there was no midfield. Like, there was constantly that Villarreal leaving McTominay as your lone holding midfielder. Like, he can't play that position. And every time there was an issue, Solskjaer's only suggestion was, oh, Pogba played, I'll drop Pogba. So he drops Pogba for the Atalanta match, and that match changed when Paul Pogba came on. Paul Pogba came on and started passing the ball forward that the midfield wasn't doing. And he left him off against Liverpool, and he brought him on against Liverpool, and that was a disaster. He gets that red card, but then Solskjaer's like, okay, he changed the match against Atalanta, so I'm going to start him against Atalanta away. And that turns out to be a disaster, too. He starts him next to McTominay. We know that doesn't work. Teams just sit and force the ball to McTominay. He can't beat you. They play terribly. This is where two goals come. I forget how they scored the first one. The second one comes from Eric Bailly just ball watching and letting his man run free. Maguire's not fast enough to come over and stop the play.
Maguire basically has to keep track of the entire half of his field at certain points. Because after the first goal, United were still getting forward. They were still creating chances. And a lot of Liverpool fans tweeted about this, that Liverpool were not particularly looking very strong at the back. And it looked like United might have scored a couple if they were executing better. But when they got the ball and they looked forward, there's so much space to work with. And every time Manchester United were just having to defend in transition because of holes left in midfield.
Yeah, and the same thing happens against Atalanta, where Bailly's ball watching on their second goal. Maguire's coming over, doesn't get there in time. He's not fast. Luke Shaw plays the man onside by like a toenail, and everybody rushes to blame Maguire and Shaw. And yeah, Maguire was hurt against Leicester and Liverpool, and he never should have played. They didn't lose that match because Maguire was bad. They lost that match for a lot of other reasons, and Maguire just couldn't do anything. This is really where it takes hold of Harry Maguire's the issue, and it becomes this narrative of blame Maguire for anything, whereas Bailly makes the mistake, and it's, oh, but Maguire's not good enough to fix that mistake. And then later, Bailly makes another horrific mistake, comes back and blocks a shot, and it's like, well, that's how good Bailly is. And it's like, well, Bailly's making the mistakes himself. But Solskjaer then goes, he doesn't know what to do. So he goes with a back three against Tottenham, where they win that match in a game that was much more Tottenham not really being good than this is actually first, wasn't it? This was first. Tottenham.
Yeah,
actually,
this was before Atalanta away. It
was much more of a case of Tottenham not being good than United figuring it out and solving it.
Yeah, they sat back a lot. I remember in the first half, and Tottenham just didn't do anything. This was, I think, the last game that Nuno Espirito Santo managed, right? Tottenham were a mess coming into this season, and, you know, in hindsight for them, not yielding to Antonio Conte wanting to actually get some investment in his team and taking over in June instead of November or whenever he took over, was a pretty big mistake for them. And getting top four after that was a little bit of a let off. Because looking at Manchester United season, they and Chelsea, they might have been in third place. Anyway, back to Manchester United.
They get the win, and then they get the draw against Atalanta. Ronaldo comes up huge again. Bailly has one of those games where it looks like he's playing really well because he does make those last minute blocks and everything. But careless errors are the reason why you drew this game instead of won it. They go back to City, and you come for a derby where it was obvious they were going to stick with that back three. Everyone knew it, including Pep. And so it doesn't take City long to really know exactly how to attack it. It doesn't take Eric Bailly long to make his stamp. He scores an own goal like within 8 minutes, I think. And in the second half, City take their feet completely off the gas, say, we challenge United to just bring the game to us, and they just couldn't. It's a complete inept performance. The less we say about it, the better. It goes into an international break, though, and you're sitting there being like, oh, okay, good. They're gonna let Solskjaer off because, again, not his fault, but he's offering zero solutions.
And also best to do it when it's quieter.
Right, and like, it's an international break. You get time. You get a new guy to come in, and they just inexplicably don't sack him. And now you come back to face Watford, where he's now in a situation where you can't. Paul Pogba's hurt and suspended. Fred's landed from Brazil like an hour ago, so he couldn't play in any of those first games back.
Both Lindelof and the guy you brought in to push Lindelof are hurt.
but Lindelof played, and you got to start a Matic McTominay midfield. And there's the thing: they get completely overrun by Watford. No surprise there, because as many problems as this team had, it was the midfield. They never got a chance to play in these games because their midfield was so inept. They go down quickly to Watford. He does make a change in the second half. He he goes to a three-man midfield of Matic, Van de Beek, and Bruno Fernandes. He brings on Martial, and United actually look really good in the second half. They score a goal. They're down 2-1. They're knocking on the door for a second one when Harry Maguire just takes two terrible yellow cards, gets sent off. It's not like a seesaw where it tilted to the other side. It just becomes much harder for them to get anything going. And then like the last 2 minutes of injury time, they concede two more goals to make it look way worse than it actually was. There's no way Solskjaer could stay on from this match. The Watford fans were singing "Always at the Wheel" the entire time. But you go after the match and like the fans are all up in arms, and Bruno's out there basically being like, "It's not just Ollie, like it's on the players as well." So like there's still that connection. We didn't talk about it, but after that West Ham match where they won it at the death, remember Solskjaer came onto the pitch and the players threw him into the middle of the pile to celebrate. Like this is a team that very much connected with this guy.
Right.
But it was time for him to go. And they do. They finally move on, and in typical United fashion, they have no plan. They waited a week too long. They have zero plan for what they're going to do. And we get the Michael Carrick interim stage where they get a 2-0 win against Villarreal to secure qualification for the Champions League, come home, get a 1-1 draw against Chelsea that no one thought they were going to get. And they beat Arsenal 3-2. But, like, was it really that good of a period, Colin?
Oh, you're asking me? I thought you said it wasn't really that good of a period. I mean, it was emergency management of a situation that they'd let spiral out of control. I think from the Glazers' point of view, it's probably the best-case scenario of, you know, you secure knockout stages of Champions League and you don't embarrass yourselves anymore against two high-profile opponents. But they spent that time recruiting the next manager, Ralf Rangnick, to come in as an interim. They made a really big deal about, you know, this is a guy who's going to come in. He's going to evaluate the squad. He's going to start to implement certain changes in the way that they play. And he's going to be an advisor going forward. And, you know, looking back at this in hindsight, it was just another case of them acting on the fly, trying to make up for their own mistakes.
Knowing what you know now, do you think the season plays out better if they stuck with Carrick for the rest of the year? Not that Carrick wanted to. He said, "I'm going to leave once you find a new manager." But if they were to convince him to be the interim manager for the rest of the year, do you think it goes better?
I mean, to be totally honest, there have been times this season where I thought it would have been better to stick with Ollie until the end of the season. I don't actually think, you know, things would have gotten much better. I don't know if we would have finished top four like some people are saying we would have. But, and it's fair to mention, because this is something that wasn't connected to Ralf Rangnick, but like you mentioned with this connection Ollie had with a lot of the players, you know, that really matters too, as in this situation, is especially it matters as much as tactics almost, because the first couple of months where Rangnick comes in, he's working with a squad that, you know, is soaking in the failure of what has happened so far. They're readjusting what their goals are for the rest of the season and what they're able to do, and they're also starting to point fingers at each other, because this is a manager who showed a lot of them trust and belief when, you know, people had written off this Manchester United team as a bunch of losers who got their manager sacked. And now it's happened again. And it's a guy that they really liked. And it just became a much bigger mess than I think a lot of us thought it would become at the time. Because we thought, you know, Rangnick's got a pretty easy schedule. If he can sort out, you know.
You're getting ahead of ourselves here.
Yeah, I am.
Go ahead.
To answer your question, I think if Michael Carrick had taken it to the rest of the season, I'm not sure it would have been much better. No.
I think it's the most overrated stretch of the season. Carrick came in and he played them in a 4-4-2, like a basic 4-4-2 against Villarreal, and they beat a bad Villarreal side who managed to make it to the Champions League semifinal. So maybe I shouldn't say bad, but a Villarreal side that certainly weren't trying that night. Mm-hmm. Came home and played a 4-3, like a diamond 4-4-2 basically against Chelsea, where they hung on for dear life. David De Gea masterclass. Like, they had no business being in that game. They took three shots. Two of them were off of horrific Chelsea errors. They did not give themselves a chance to win that game, other than the fact that they got lucky that De Gea was standing on his head.
Right, they were playing for themselves.
And then they got a wild win against Arsenal, which Ragnick then gave his first press conference and said, yeah, I was at the match last night and it was exciting, but, like, you can't play like that and expect to win, which he's right.
Yeah, that game was nuts. It kind of reminded me of the one near the end of Jose Mourinho's era where it was like a 2-2 against Arsenal, where I think Lingard scored like 10 seconds after Arsenal had just scored and they kicked off again. But yeah, it was not sustainable play. And I think Carrick would have been way in over his head if he was going to stay on for the rest of the season. But I also think Carrick knew that. And I think Carrick is another person who just needed to unplug for a while after that experience of the collapse. Because when something you work really hard towards suddenly falls apart the way that it did, it's almost unfair to expect everyone involved to keep going for another 5 or 6 months. You know, it's just hard. Ollie came in and maybe made it look a bit easier than it was for those couple of months where it was Ollie at the wheel. But you look at, you know, the decline after that, it's not an easy job to just immediately start changing things in November when you've got so much of the season still ahead of you. If they had resigned to not making top four, and I don't know. I don't even know what kind of expectations there were when Ragnick came in within the squad, but it definitely did not.
I don't know what they were within the squad, but you remember the backdrop of a whole season and a half of people just being like, Solskjaer's a terrible coach, and this is a talented squad that needs proper coaching. And now Ralf Ragnick, the father of gang and pressing, a proper coach, a proper tactician, is coming in. This is going to be good. And Ragnick arrives. We get the next section of – it's only about four games, but he shows up to play Crystal Palace, and this immediately looks like a Ragnick team, and everybody's mm-hmm. just gushing over it. Oh, look at how well-coached they are and how everything – they're only able to sustain that for about 65 minutes, which is what you should expect. They struggle in attack, which is what you should expect, but they get the win, and it's a really good sign of things to come. They then play a dead rubber against Young Boys, which is probably only notable for the fact that Ragnick did even more 11 names on a sheet than Ollie did against West Ham.
But also notable. He brought on, was it Charlie Savage and Zidane Iqbal, and this whole thing was made about they're going to get their debut, and he waits so long to put them on that. And then, like, the ball stays in play during stoppage time. It's like they got to be on the field for like 30 seconds.
Yeah.
In a game where you could have just started them. Like, it doesn't matter.
I thought the only thing notable about this match was that Van de Beek and Juan Mata were the midfield pivot, and Juan Mata looked like the better midfielder.
Right.
It was not a good sign for Donny Van de Beek. They struggled against Norwich, where I think that game sort of exposed the 4-2-2-2 as exposing Ronaldo, because he kept getting the ball in these situations where he's a little bit wider than he wanted to be, and he couldn't beat players off the dribble. Same sort of thing happening against Newcastle. And that was the end of Ragnick playing Ragnick ball. If you want to know how was this period of four games, really three games, because Young Boys is a thing, it's like, it depends on who you ask, because everybody on Twitter was gushing, oh, Ragnick's coming in, we're starting to press, they're so well structured, this is such a great team. Others will say the 4-2-2-2 was a terrible idea. The players were completely lost. It's not as bad as those people will say, and it's also, it wasn't as good as others are going to say.
Yeah, we're this whole season, to me, I think when I look back on it, a lot of what I'm going to remember about it is how reactionary a lot of this fan base is.
Everything became.
Yeah, it's just like game by game, there were so many new, like, I think you wrote at one point, I was editing one of your pieces, and you said it was like going through the motions of learning everything Ole Gunnar Solskjaer had already learned about this team, and like different strategies you can use to paper over like the midfield and things like that. Like it really did feel like that at times. And this is where the trend we talked about earlier, where it's like, okay, United are back in this game. Maybe they'll go on and win it. And then they just, you know, lay an egg. It's like, the only situation where I think it was like, oh, they're down and out, and then they came back and they won it, was Leeds. And that they didn't even go behind in that game. They blew a 2-0 lead.
Yeah, they just blew it.
Yeah. I think I'm getting ahead of myself because that's probably later in the season.
Yeah.
But yeah, this was also weird because like half the squad got COVID at one point, and there were games postponed. And then, you know, all these articles start coming about, you know, rumors from the dressing room and leaks at Manchester United. And people start pointing the finger at whoever they want to because of, you know, it's like, I don't like this player, so it's probably him, stuff like that. It just really started to kind of unravel off the pitch at that point, I think. And then, yeah, of course.
It's exactly what it is. Like, we go to January, the mentality monsters come out of, everybody's accusing the team of having a poor mentality. Funny how, like, leaks from the dressing room kind of stopped after Donny van de Beek went on loan. But we'll get there. January comes, like, they start getting results, but you're constantly asking, like, is this good? Ragnick switches things up to, like, the 4-4-2 and gets a 3-1 win over Burnley, who were atrocious in this match. It's, like, begging. This was so much of a Burnley were bad rather than United were good match.
Mm-hmm.
And McTominay gets his only goal of the season, his only Premier League goal of the season after taking the ball off of it. Ronaldo has that heavy touch, and McTominay just runs onto him and goes, right, I'm going to shoot that in. But it gets so overblown quickly of like, is this a case of United being good and turning a corner and starting to figure it out? Or is it a case of Burnley being really bad? And Ralph decides it's United being good because he runs back the same 11. Bruno was suspended for the Burnley match. He wasn't suspended the next match against Wolves. He just doesn't play him. Mm-hmm. He loses Harry Maguire, and he starts Varane and Phil Jones, and they promptly lose. And they were never in this match. That's where I thought, like, he's learning everything. Like, he's learning, oh, McTominay and Matic can't play together. And they managed to survive because it was freaking Burnley.
This Wolves match sucks because the goal came, I believe, at the end, and it was like off of Phil Jones, like misheader or something, trying to clear the ball.
Yeah.
And like Phil Jones had to play in this match. There weren't other options. And it was a really nice reception for a player who has also been the subject of a lot of, you know, humiliation on the part of fans, you know, myself included at times, I think. But you know, for the most part, Phil Jones is a player that I liked and have defended before. And, you know, him coming back to maybe play a couple games, you know, maybe he discovers some form. The FA Cup's coming up. Maybe he can play in that one. And then to see the game end like that, it just sucked. There are all these, like, it's like if this season was a Sunday, like that's the cherry on top. There's like a lot of different cherries, except this is the worst Sunday you've ever had. And these cherries are rotten. And there's just a lot of those throughout the season.
The irony is that it was after this match where the cries on Twitter about how this team has no mentality, no leadership were the loudest. And people are blaming that on Maguire. But look at who the captain of the team was in this game. It was Ronaldo. And they were. There was this. It was an abjectly pathetic display. Granted, we've known for 4 years that McTominay and Matic is not a formidable midfield pair, and it starts there. If you don't have a midfield, you're not going to be able to do anything, and United couldn't do anything. They had no Luke Shaw. They had no Harry Maguire. They start, I think, up front, it was Ronaldo, might have been Rashford and Greenwood. It was still Greenwood. Greenwood had gone, was dropped when Ragnick first came in. Now he was back in the team, and you were constantly getting these team sheets where basically nobody from the back six was a progressive passer or could move the ball up the pitch. And your front three were three shoot first forwards. And your only somewhat creator was Bruno, who had to drop so deep to get the ball because nobody could get it up there, that you then lacked a creator up the pitch because Bruno was doing all the progression. So not having Maguire hurt them, not having Shaw hurt them. But of course, people are trying to paint the problems as them. You get other people trying to paint the problems as Ronaldo, and it's like, it's neither of the issues. It's a lot of it is you have no stinking midfielders. It's all of them. It's none of them. It's all this. They got played off the pitch by Villa in the FA Cup, but they got that early McTominay goal because McTominay always gets a nice little hot streak in January off of a set piece, and they hold on for a win. Then go to Villa Park in what I wouldn't have said this if I didn't read about it earlier today. Probably turned out to be the most important match of the season, where Gerrard completely beats Ragnick in the tactical chess match, making adjustments at halftime, making counter moves to Ragnick, mm-hmm. where United kind of didn't even deserve their 2-0 lead, but they got one. And then the last 15 minutes, Gerrard, the moves, Nemanja Matic has no legs. They come back, they get those two goals. I think this is when the doubts started to go into the players' heads.
The doubts in terms of Ragnick or just like...
Yeah. In terms of Ralph Ragnick, he did... Gerrard kept making these tweaks where at halftime he moved Buendia over to the other side of the field to overload Fred. So Ragnick pushed Fred up. And that worked. It got them their second goal. But it left Greenwood and Dalot, both of whom are not good defenders, isolated on that side. So Gerrard countered by bringing on Coutinho and basically being like, Nemanja Matic has way too much to defend here. And Ragnick had no idea how to deal with that. After the game, he said, well, I thought about going three at the back, but I thought that would send the wrong message. And it just seemed like that was the only idea he had. He left Cavani on, Cavani runs like there's no tomorrow, but he's also 35 years old or 34 years old and probably can't run like there's no tomorrow and for 90 minutes. Really
played consistently throughout the season as well. I mean,
right. So just like bring on a Jesse Lingard to run around and do your pressing and fall in and stuff. And hold up the lead. He didn't seem to have any idea other than, oh, back three. And then he was too scared to do it. And because Maguire wasn't on the pitch and there was no Shaw, there was no possession coming out of the back. So it was just attack, clear the ball either for a throw in or just back to Villa's defenders and wait for Villa to come back at you. And that's always a recipe for conceding late. And that's exactly what happened. And I think that's when the doubts sort of got sown into United's minds of like, maybe this coach, along with his Ted Lasso assistants, don't really know what to do here. And they go from there to the Brentford match where they win 3-1, but they never should have been in this game. They were played off the pitch in the first half.
It was one of those like, you might as well just, unless you're Manchester City or Liverpool, you might as well just sit back and let United try and figure you out. Because if you're going to leave yourself open, you actually probably give this United team a better chance of picking you off. I think what two of their three goals came in transition, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And it was kind of the same case in the next match against West Ham where, you know, it was just kind of like a freak goal that they won on. This wasn't anything.
That was the one time West Ham got forward and United came back the other way.
Yeah.
And it was very Ralph threw everything in the kitchen sink at them. Like they finished the match with like a front four of like Cavani, Rashford, Ronaldo and Martial.
Yeah. Yeah, this was a really weird period because it was like the FA Cup match comes and that's another like stinker
It's the next period.
Oh, okay. I won't get into that then, but you know, like I know we weren't going to mention, you know, some of the more difficult stuff to talk about off the pitch when it comes to the players, but like the Mason Greenwood thing happening too, I think in this period.
Happened right after the West Ham match.
Yeah. It's just throw in another like awful thing to happen that, you know, this is out a lot, you know, a lot of the players, you know, may or may not have known about it, whatever, but like, you know, this is someone who's their teammate and you find out, you know, these horrible things that he's, you know, alleged to have done. And it becomes another thing for everyone to talk about. It becomes this whole other distraction on top of, you know, dealing with this manager who hasn't figured out how to play this team yet. And
your players looking at the thing that kept happening was, for all the calls about Solskjaer having no build-up play and no patterns and no nothing, there was none of that under Ragnick. And you can't, and like Luke Shaw being out of the team, sometimes injured, sometimes on preference. You have Alex Telles not doing anything on the left back, which Luke Shaw does a lot because the midfield doesn't do anything. And that was one of the ways that Solskjaer compensated for that, was I'm going to have Maguire do more and Luke Shaw's going to do more. And now you have the midfield not doing anything. You have a left back who's not going to do anything. You're playing without Maguire a lot. That the players just keep looking and being like, well, you're asking people to do jobs that they are not capable of doing. And they, week in, week out, are proving to you they are not capable of doing said job.
Meanwhile, also changing up everyone else's job.
Right. I understand why some of these guys are playing, because we have nobody else. But you're not doing anything to mitigate and try to help them out in the areas that they're weaker in. And you've got a Bruno Fernandes not playing to his strengths, but he's got a cover for Greenwood and Ronaldo defensively. You keep playing Greenwood and Ronaldo, despite the fact that they comically will not pass to each other. At the end of the season, Ronaldo had the primary pass on one Mason Greenwood shot. And I think Greenwood had like seven times pass to Ronaldo to set up a shot. And You keep playing three forwards that are shoot first forwards with no creativity. So this is that January month, they got results, but it was like, is this good? I don't know. And it never really looked like it was clicking, and you could understand why the players might have doubts. So then you go to you turn the calendar to February, the Mason Greenwood thing happens, he's out of the team, and Ragnick kind of used that as a chance to really centralize the team's attack around Ronaldo. It's going to be the Cristiano Ronaldo show. He says that's going to be the best way to get results.
Also,
Jadon Sancho comes back into the team.
You don't have forward options anymore.
Right. Martial is on loan. Cavani's not yet hurt, actually. That's a thing that gets lost. Cavani's still there. But he goes, Cristiano Ronaldo's going to lead the team. Jadon Sancho comes back in because Greenwood is now out and there's a spot there. And that turns out to be very good if you want Cristiano Ronaldo to be your guy, because Jadon Sancho creates a lot of shots. And the numbers start to look really good. They start creating a lot. Their defense is pretty good. It's definitely improved. It seems like they've turned a corner, but they're not turning it into results through the month of February. Ralph really, he starts to use McTominay as that lone six who constantly throughout every match lets us know he's not good at that position. He can't play that position. But at this point, we're so into the Harry Maguire blame game that everything just gets blamed on Maguire. And they get bounced out of the FA Cup by Borough, which is probably a microcosm of what's to come. Like, their XG was like over 4. They only scored one goal. Ronaldo takes 10 out of the 30 shots.
It was definitely an indicator of what Ronaldo's form over the next month or so was going to be.
Ronaldo takes 10 out of the 30 shots, and that's a third, which is exactly how many he took of over the next month. He took a third of United shots. He scores he didn't score the goal. Someone else scored the goal. He missed a penalty, though. That's huge. Like, now, Bruno missed chances too, and Bruno missed like an easy sitter, or not a sitter, but a very good chance as well. So it's not all on Ronaldo, but when you're taking a third of the shots, you need to deliver. And they concede an equalizer to Borough. That's exactly, Varane gets caught up the pitch. leaves Maguire alone. Maguire obviously doesn't stop it. Pogba's late to come back. McTominay doesn't even bother trying to come back. And it becomes 1-1. And what happens next? Bruno and Pogba spend the next however many minutes of regular time and extra time playing hero ball. And it doesn't work. And the script repeats itself. They go to Burnley. They get that early goal. They concede a goal when McTominay just runs into Maguire rather than running to cover for Maguire, who steps out on a play and leaves Varane 2v1. They have no ideas after that equalizer happens. Southampton 1-0, concede again. No, there's just no answers. And all the while, Ronaldo's getting chance after chance after chance, and he's not scoring. And he's taking, again, he's taking a third of the shots. They rebound with a win against Brighton. They come alive against Leeds, which, again, Leeds unique.
It's weird game, very fun to watch. Not something you can take away, you know, big.
It doesn't look anything like the previous games they played. It was just another Fred goal.
Both times, which is weird because Brentford. Because Brentford are a team, I think it was like 3-0 both times or 3-1 one of the times. It's just weird.
And then they go and put out like an absolutely atrocious display against Atletico Madrid that somehow ends 1-1. It is the most undeserving 1-1 draw you'll ever see.
Again, the only goal coming when Atletico pushed up a little bit and left space in behind.
Yeah. And then they come home for another 0-0 draw against Watford, where they just pounded the Watford net and didn't score. And this is where Ronaldo killed you, because he had one goal in this stretch on an XG of 4.1, and he had a third of United shots. Nobody on United under Solskjaer took shots at that volume. The chances were much more evenly distributed. But Ragnik decided my best chance here is through Ronaldo, and that's a fair assumption. And United did it. They did the work. They created chances, and Ronaldo simply failed to come through, and they win two games out of this stretch. And that drops them down the table.
It's like, you know, we'll talk about the final stretch or whatever, but it was like everyone else had given up by that point, and then Ronaldo starts scoring goals. You know, it was a really frustrating period for a lot of reasons, and I think for me, the loss in the Manchester derby really just kind of solidified my feeling of I don't really care what happens with Rangnick after this season. You know, I think it's obviously laughable that United would bring in somebody for potentially a long-term role and give him the opportunity to evaluate the squad and then just dismiss him, like, you know, just acting on the fly again to cover up, you know, these fundamental problems with this team that date back to 2013, whatever. But he did a really, really bad interim job.
Yeah. That becomes very, very apparent as we turn the calendar to March and we see the next section of, like, there's just this over-reliance on Ronaldo, and it all starts to slip away from Ralph because he doesn't know what he's doing if Ronaldo's not there. They go into the derby, he decides, I can't play with Ronaldo up top in the derby, which is a fair assumption because if you're going to want to defend, he wants to defend and counter, but he plays that 4-4-2 with Bruno and Pogba as the double false nines, which just ends up leaving McTominay and Fred completely isolated in midfield. City pick on McTominay the entire match. They go, oh, all you have to do is stand near McTominay and then walk away from him and he won't follow you. Ragnick wants to play on the counter, but he has no idea how to do it. He doesn't know how to set up his team in a 4-4-2 and bank and get back. And then you come back to the Spurs match a week later, and that's what United become. Ronaldo scores a hat trick, obviously, because he returns to the mean for his XG regression. If now he's got like four goals on 5.1 XG.
I mean, he hit at least some of his goal bonuses because of this last stretch of the season.
Right. And it's like, and if you just distribute his goals better, United would come away with more points in right. this stretch. But he shops at Costco. He gets them all in bulk. And that's what United are now. Ronaldo gets the hat trick. They win the match. Then a week later, then he goes and puts on another pathetic display against Atletico. Just obviously, this isn't that long ago, because how many knockout games have United played since then? But it's the worst knockout tie that United have had since Sevilla in 2018.
Yeah, these two of the worst football games I've ever watched. I don't want to. I mean, I've watched some entertaining Atletico games where they just do the exact same thing to some other team. But when they're doing it to your team, and your team is as useless as they are when they have possession all the time, it's just absolutely abysmal.
And then
we get a blessed 2 weeks off from the season.
Oh yeah, that was probably the best part of the season, other than the Leeds match. But then they come back and lay an absolute egg against Leicester. Ronaldo isn't there. I guess his hip flexor was acting up again, so he goes with the 4-4-2 with the double false nine. At this point, Cavani is hurt. But he goes with the double false nines again, and obviously it's terrible. Mm-hmm. Nobody looks like they know what they're doing, and at the same time, you have, again, your midfield needs to put you in positions where you can be good, and they can't, and that's not their fault. They're being asked to do things that are beyond their skill set, and they follow that up again. They come back a week later, but also... it just shows Ragnik has no idea what to do when Ronaldo's not around anymore. And the players know it. When they go down against Leicester and they score, Fred scores like 4 minutes after that to equalize it. But now there's 20 minutes to go and they have no ideas because they have no faith in their coach. And it's Pogba and Bruno playing hero ball again. Whereas last season, how many times were they needing a goal over the last 25 minutes of a match? And they just stayed calm, kept playing their game, and said, yeah, chances are going to come. We're going to score. It's night and day. And it just shows you how little faith they have. They go to Everton, where they lose to Frank Lampard. Because, again, no build-up play. They're not compact. There's no patterns. They don't have Shaw. So, like, you're asking McTominay to handle your build-up. He can't do that. It was just like, what coach looked at this plan and said, oh yeah, this is a good idea. And at this point, they're just a very not well-coached team, but the fans at this point have just completely turned on the players, and Ralph is right there helping them out. He's throwing all the players under the bus as well.
Yeah. He's saying literally whatever, we'll just, it's the same thing with the like news reports at this point as well. And I mean, probably throughout the whole season, because you're just getting a lot of like sometimes conflicting reports that are just blaming certain people that you know that fans on Twitter are just going to eat that up. You know, Eric Ten Hag rumors have started by this point, like who he's going to want to keep. I've seen probably 5 different reports on what Eric Ten Hag thinks about Harry Maguire by this point. This was the period where I think everyone had just given up. And then, I mean, what match were we even on at that point? I mean, yeah, you got the 2 Ronaldo hat tricks, which were fun to watch. I'm not
right. We get to that. So then, yeah, it's Ronaldo fun. Comes back against Norwich and scores, and United win again. And then they go to Liverpool, where there's again just no freaking plan, and they get blown, and the doors get blown off them again. And that just starts another round of how can you not even show up at Anfield? Don't you have any pride? Yeah. And Ralph's throwing the players on the bus, but Ralph was smart about this. Because at this point, he has established that, like, everything that he said is he establishes I'm the truth teller. And that started back in January with, like, the Martial saga, where Martial was left out of the team, and Ralph basically said he wanted to be left out. And then he completely throws Martial under the bus. And for the first time in, like, I don't even know, all of a sudden the players are talking back publicly, putting out posts being like, this isn't what happened.
Right.
And it was pretty clear, at least in the Martial situation, that there was a misunderstanding. And like where Ralph's from, if you want to do this, you say that. Or if you don't want X, you don't do Y. And where Martial's from, it's like, if I don't want X, then I just don't say X. Or, what, you know, cultural differences there it was clear there was a misunderstanding, but Ralph establishes it. Well, this is what happened. And basically establishes that credibility for the rest of everything. So whatever he says now, everybody's yupping up as this is definitely the truth. And I'm not sitting here and saying he was lying about everything. Mm-hmm. I'm just saying that there's two sides to stories and that one side might not be completely true, but that's the side that everybody yups up. Or sometimes it's the side that everybody yups up and sometimes not.
Potentially, he knew by this point, too, that he wasn't staying on. You know, that may have only just been made available to us last week or whatever, that, or what was it, Sunday when the report came out that he and the club have severed ties or whatever. If that one report that came out that Ragnick and Ten Hag had talked on the phone and, you know, there were some disagreements, if that phone call happened around this time when Erik ten Hag knew he was coming in, then, you know, Ralph might have known by that point that he wasn't part of the future plans anyway.
Yeah, and he tries to pass the blame for everything. Like, here's the deal. Some of these players are not good enough. And it's not some of them are not put in a position to be good enough. Some of them are not given the chance because other players aren't performing. But that Ralph's the coach, and he's the one that's supposed to try to make everyone play to the best of their abilities, and he's not doing that either. And the Liverpool match is that big crescendo, and at that point, yeah, like you said, Ralph's given up. The players have given up.
And this really, and the Arsenal game too, between the Liverpool game and the Arsenal game is when things really kick off in terms of just like absolutely abhorrent fan behavior with,
yeah, so
I mean the singing of the Hillsborough song, you know, the about the Sun and accusing Liverpool fans of being murderers because of Hillsborough, and then the bomb threat to Harry Maguire's family I think a couple of days after was just,
yeah, it's name something bad and name rock bottom and you probably United probably sunk lower in terms of the club, the fan base, everything. After the Liverpool match, it's basically, I think they're at that point they were eliminated from the top four. So now you have nothing to play for because it was almost impossible to fall out of Europe altogether. It was almost impossible to fall out of the Europa League, and they somehow managed to make that almost possible.
I'll be honest, I kind of wish it happened.
It would have been funny.
It just
the only reason it's good is because it gives Ten Hag another avenue to the Champions League, but like there's a difference between Ten Hag going to the Europa League and saying this is an avenue to the Champions League, and like when Jose Mourinho did it when United were very clearly the best team in that competition, and it was not really a question whether
now
they
it's
win
actually
or not.
Like something teams care about
winning. And it's like, oh yeah, they are going to be good in that competition, or they should be good, but it's no, I saw a lot of similarities the last few games to the end of the 18-19 season under Ollie, mm-hmm. where just by the end of it, especially the Huddersfield and Cardiff matches when they were out of the Champions League and they had nothing to play for, mm-hmm. but everybody's hobbled and injured. I'm harping on like Scott McTominay keeps getting asked to do a job that he absolutely cannot do, but there was nobody else. Fred was injured for a good chunk. Pog was injured. Like they literally have no other midfielders that they could even ask to come in and play. He plays Matic and in 5 years, 20% of the minutes that Matic and McTominay play are under Ralph Ragnick together.
Like, but some of that was by choice. A lot of that was by choice.
Oh no, I think it's like 30%, and then 20% of like Ragnick's minutes, both of them were playing. Like that's just an absurd number. I get it. He has no other options. Everybody's mad at him because he keeps throwing the same option, the same old guys out there to fit and not playing any of the kids. But like that's probably the best thing Ragnick did, is not throwing kids into this dysfunction of a team where the players hate each other and it's just not working and there's no cohesive unit. If they would have had a midfielder, maybe I'd say try that guy because he can't be worse. But they don't have a midfielder. They had other attackers and fullbacks and stuff, and it was like playing them is not going to help. The biggest problem here is now United are out of everything. They're playing once a week. Ronaldo comes alive and scores in three straight matches, and suddenly it's like, well, how can you drop him? Look at what this is the crux of the Ronaldo problem is he comes alive when United he had taken a week off before the Tottenham game. He flew back to Portugal because his hip flexor hurt when he was suddenly started hurting when he was told that he couldn't play against City. And I think the Norwich game came after a week off. Yeah, he didn't play against Everton or Leicester or something. He had time off before the Norwich game also. So suddenly he's getting time off and he's coming back and scoring hat tricks. And now they're only playing once a week and he keeps scoring. And it's like, yeah, 37 years old. You can only play once a week. But he gets so offended when he gets dropped. He gets so offended when he's dropped from a Champions League dead rubber against Young Boys. And it becomes such a story when Ole Gunnar Solskjaer chooses to rest him against Everton and when Carrick drops him against Chelsea and basically whenever he's not in the team, that how do you manage that?
Cristiano Ronaldo is like, I feel like I've probably unfairly put a lot of the blame for this season on Cristiano Ronaldo.
I certainly did too. And like I've been trying to emphasize,
I gotta give him whatever flowers he wants. You know, he scored some really cool goals at times. I think if Erik ten Hag takes the last month of this season as evidence that he should keep Cristiano Ronaldo, as some reports possibly falsely are suggesting, we may be in for another trying 3 years of whatever this rebuild is. Because, like, I'm not sure I can take another season of this guy.
Right, yeah. Like, this was not his fault, but, like, by no means did he have a good season.
These goals did not come out of playing a certain way that's going to be beneficial long-term. It didn't come out of establishing anything that's going to be good for the team long-term. Like, these goals are a microcosm in a season of just absolute dog shit.
He scored in 10 games. He scored goals in 10 games. And if you look at players in the Premier League who score 20 non-penalty goals in a season over the last decade or so, and I mean, I even included Rooney and Van Persie when I looked into this, the average number of games that they score in is like 17. And so if you score one goal in 17 games, it's almost a goal every other game, but it is basically a goal every other game because like none of them played 38 games. It's a goal every other game, and then mixed in there's like 4-5 games where you score a couple of goals or get a hat trick. That's the line. And Ronaldo, he scored in 10 games, and in how many of them did he score multiple goals? The Newcastle, Arsenal.
Right, two hat tricks.
Tottenham, Norwich. So four of them he scored multiple goals, which is the right number. That's about you want 4 or 5. But you got to score in more than 10 matches.
Yeah. The suggestion that he is one of the six best players in the Premier League this season is insulting to a lot of other Premier League players.
Well, he's there because of his goals, and somehow they left off the Golden Boot winner.
I mean, he's there because he's Cristiano Ronaldo. I mean, that's what all of this comes down to. Is like, if Cristiano Ronaldo was some other 37-year-old that we signed this season who had no history with this club, I mean, are fans talking about him in the same way at the end of the season?
Exactly.
Even leaving his career with Real Madrid intact. Like,
if you break it down to a strictly production level, then United last season got, between Martial and Cavani, they got 14 non-penalty goals from their strikers. Ronaldo comes in this season, he got 15 in a lot more minutes.
Right.
That's not. And what were the expectations? Did he meet expectations? The expectations, because when he came, was, oh, he's going to get you 20 to 25 goals. He's a guaranteed goal scorer. So this he didn't meet expectations. He didn't. And on the same token, you could say Jadon Sancho replaced, you could say he replaced Dan James. And they probably played a comparable amount of minutes because Sancho didn't play that as much as some people, me included, would have liked him to play. Mm-hmm. And James finished last season with like 3 goals and 4 assists. Sancho finished with 3 and 3. So obviously the underlying numbers are way better for Sancho, but from a strictly production standpoint, you could say he didn't make the team any better either. Like they're both failures. Granted, Sancho is 21, turning 22, and will be here for a while, and he's a player you could build around. Mm-hmm. Ronaldo's if you want to look at why this team isn't in the Champions League, it's very easy to look back at that stretch of time in February where they dominated matches and came away with nothing to show for it.
Yep. I mean, we could be here for another hour if we're just going to spend it talking about all the reasons that we hated Ronaldo this season. There's going to be a big rift in terms of my trust of Erik ten Hag if he looks at Cristiano Ronaldo this season and thinks I'll have me some of that.
Mine is strictly, I could care less what he does with Ronaldo. Just like if he looks in the midfield and says, yeah, this'll do. Because that was like, we tried to break this down in a tactical way of every problem that came up was ultimately a midfield problem. And Solskjaer kept throughout his tenure, he kept trying to figure it out. He switched to a 4-3-3, he switched to a bunch of different things. He dropped Pogba, he put in Pogba, and he never seemed to be able to do it. Ralf Rangnick could never figure it out. He seemed hell-bent on just keeping McTominay there, but Pogba was injured for a lot of his tenure. Ralf did say, well, the players didn't listen to me, and it's, you know, Scott McTominay is famous. Like, when he says that, who's he referring to? Because everybody wants to blame it on certain players. And it's like, Scott McTominay is famous for playing simply because he does exactly what the manager tells you to do. So when you say like McTominay, there were several instances where like McTominay just wasn't good enough to do what needed to be done. And if you're trying to defend him to say like, well, we all know that the players stopped listening. It's like McTominay very much listens. Bruno Fernandes is, other than the rogue pressing every so often, he listens. Like, you can use Bruno in different systems, in different positions, and he will do the job you tell him to do. Luke Shaw is someone that you tell him what to do, and he does exactly. He's one of the most coachable players United have had over the last few years. We also know that Ronaldo went to Rangnick, and basically Rangnick, indirectly, but sort of threw Ronaldo under the bus, where he said, hey, you know, some players just weren't doing it, so I had to make compromises. And I think once he lost the thing that he's known for, the players lost all faith in him because there was nothing else holding, he had no gravitas to say, yeah, let's do it this way, it'll work, because it's like, you've never done that.
Right. It would have been really important, I think, for Rangnick to make that instant impact as an interim that Solskjaer did. And when things just started unraveling, it obviously became harder to do that. And there are excuses for Rangnick, but for the most part, this was something we can look back on, especially now with the knowledge that he's not going to be involved going forward, as just another really weird appointment that didn't make a lot of sense. And has possibly set United back further in a stretch of time where they already knew that they were going to be in a hole in the summer anyway.
Yeah, I don't know if I blame Rangnick for setting him back further. I don't blame Solskjaer for doing that either. I think that's the board and the lack of the not sign the right players this season. There is the notion that Rangnick exposed the squad this year. Like, if you think that, you obviously weren't paying attention. Like, Rangnick played everybody and showed they're not good enough, whereas Solskjaer just went, you're not good enough, so therefore you're not going to play. And everybody because the Sharks were in the water, were just like, he's an idiot, he's not playing these guys. And then Ragnick played them, and it was like, oh, yeah, that player is quite crap.
Yeah, but also, like, if your job is to expose the squad, what the hell kind of interim manager are you? You're supposed to be putting out fires. You know, you're supposed to
I don't think that's his job. Yeah. I think that's what everybody – again, like
– Yeah, I mean, people the
praise that Ragnick got, people didn't want – people don't want to admit they're wrong. So they're trying to be like – they're trying to find any – there's a whole group of people out there that were like, it's Ollie. It's 100% Ollie. He's a terrible coach, and when we get rid of him, it's going to get better. And Ralph Ragnick is this great coach. And Ralph Ragnick came in and he stunk, and there was no coaching in this team. And sure, maybe he couldn't bring in some of the guys he wanted to bring in because of Brexit, but it was bad. And people are grasping in ways, and we do it too in other situations. They're just trying to come up with any reason to say, no, there's positive here. But right. We could be here all day, and really all we want to do is turn the frickin' page and never look back at the 21-22 season ever again. So this was the post-mortem of that. And now hopefully we can all turn, because frankly, Erik ten Hag wants the players to start returning back to preseason in like 3 weeks, and it just never frickin' ends. Like, that's way too soon for me. I thought we had a good 2 months off, and we're right back on the grind and like, in just a few weeks. But thank you to Colin for letting me do this. It's probably why it went too long, because we know that I have too many words to say. But let's hope for something better next year.
Yeah, we thanks for listening, and we may not be back next week. I'm going on vacation at some point, and we're also just kind of running out of things to talk about, and it'll also just be nice to have a break, I think, from talking about Manchester United. When they pick up training again, maybe there'll be some new players to talk about, some transfer rumors that have evolved into potentially realistic scenarios, whatever. We'll get to that when we get to it. But yeah, thanks for sticking with us.